I like that it didn't look good, though. Like, I don't, like, not every anime has to be attractive looking anime. Andy,
that's true.
Anime,
that's true. Andy-may. Andy-may.
Welcome to Keyframes, a podcast about anime. I'm your host, Ben Halliburton, and with me today are Andy.
Hiya.
Duncan.
Hey.
And Jeff.
Hello.
In our last episode, we covered the beginning of the new season, but actually I've been doing a bit of a throwback. If you'll remember, way back in episode 11, we covered Record of Lodoss War, and when they did the Blu-ray re-release, the only way you could buy it is if you bought it in a pack with the TV show that was made several years later. And I've been watching that. And I finished it, actually, because I've been sick.
No wonder you've been
scattershot nature of this episode.
No wonder you've been ill, because you've been watching garbage.
Yeah.
I mean, it's weird. Like, the funny thing is, like, okay, so you guys have probably watched an anime where the opening or the ending is so good that it just elevates your opinion of the show, even if it doesn't really deserve that elevation.
Yeah. Space yeah. Dandy.
Yeah, that's a good pull. Record of Lodoss War, Chronicles of the Heroic Knight, has possibly, no, not even possibly, easily one of the top five opening animation music things that I've ever seen. It is beautiful. It has this kind of combination between like Japanese chant and kind of an Inya song with like a very like kind of deep choral song to it. So it's got this kind of like haunting mystic melody, and it's done in this really like high depth, like kind of slow motion style, which makes everything seem really like isolated and far away. And it has like this beautiful, it just captures what you want, like, a fantasy story to be, like, something that's unfamiliar and grand and timeless. And then you cut to the show itself, which is low-budget, late-90s animation. and, like, it's 27 episodes. I watched the opening every single episode all the way through, and often it was what would make me watch the next episode. I'd be, like, pissed at what happened in the show, which is the first 9 episodes are a retelling of the second half of the OVA. And then the other 18 episodes are the next generation takes place 10 years later. This knight called Spark with his crew of mercenaries, all of whom are secretly not mercenaries, but people on important missions as they try to stop the god of death from getting resurrected. And it's just kind of average. There's a dumb thing with Carla, the like gray witch who's immortal and manipulating humanity throughout history to like stop cataclysms from happening, weirdly partners with the guy who's going to resurrect the goddess of destruction for reasons that are not clear, because if your goal is to prevent a cataclysm, you probably shouldn't team up with the guy who's resurrecting the god of death and destruction.
It's so long since I've seen that series, I can't remember if Carla at that point is in this version is female or if it's Woodchuck.
So Woodchuck escapes the circlet off screen for okay. some reason, and it's just like a girl. Is there, if they, there's a throwaway thing of like, oh, that's one of the six heroes, which are the previous generation before the band of D&D heroes that we see in Record of Lodoss War. But they don't really explain. She just like got a new body and no one really talks about it. And that's one of the problems with Chronicles of the Heroic Knight, is at the same time, it's very stretched out and kind of, it knows it has the time to like have tons of campfire talking scenes and long battle scenes where they, you know, have minimal animation and lots of panning over stills of guys holding the swords with their mouth open so they can dub in the yelling that has to be in every fantasy anime. But also it feels weirdly rushed, and that's trying to cover, I mean, we talked a lot about on the covering the OVA that it's this like bizarrely sprawling, unfocused story, and it has even more room to sprawl in Chronicles of the Heroic Knight. So I'm not recommending it, but you should look up the opening. It's called Sea of Something. it's called like Sea of Miracles. Yeah, Sea of Miracles is the song. And like, seriously, just look up Record of Lodoss War, Heroic Knight, OP. Just put that in Google. Watch that video. It's, you'll have seen the best part of the show. and otherwise, if you want to watch an extremely average D&D campaign animated poorly, well, there's probably better stuff out there for you now. But Records of Lodoss War, Chronicles of Heroic Knight was fine. It's fine.
Have you thought about going? Has it made you want to watch the latest entry at all, the Grand Crest War?
Well, that's not part of the same continuity. It's just the same author, I think.
It's just a new party. Well, it's what, I don't know. Is it the same set of things? I assume if
no,
you're gonna,
I don't.
No,
I don't think it's. New I don't setting, think it's. I it? Think it's this. It's a new setting. Yeah, it's a new setting. Okay. The continent at, because I'm looking at the Wikipedia, it's the the continent at Latin, and there's another dimension invading called Chaos. Yeah, it's the same author, Ryo Mizuno, and I think it actually used the same like tabletop setting of a Sword World, which is the name of their proprietary setting that Lodoss War is based around. But no, it's a different stuff. I don't know. Like, the storytelling is honestly the worst part of Record of Lodoss War. So being like, it's the same author makes me feel like, oh. Like, if someone else, like, wrote a story in the Lodoss War world, which actually happens because Rune Soldier Louis, if you ever heard of that, takes place in the same setting, but it's, like, not by Ryo Mizuno. And it's also a comedy where this guy wants to be a mage, but he's, like, really bad at it. And he's also, like, super buff and violent. And so he just ends up like hitting people with his wand. And
that's amazing.
There's long suffering girls like that. It's basically like, imagine like shitty fantasy Trigun is what
no,
Soldier
no.
Louis is.
Shitty fantasy Trigun is those who hunt elves, I think.
Oh god, I have that on my hard drive because someone talked me into like, they're like, it's a classic.
I don't think it's a classic, but it is a fantasy anime which has a tank in it. Which not,
right,
not just like a...
What is this anime, sorry?
It's those? Called Those Who Hunt Elves. It's like a bunch of mercenaries get teleported. It's like actually technically an isekai. Like, they get teleported to a fantasy world and they manage to bring their tank over, and they right. they find out that they can only go back by like catching one of the last surviving elves. So they just like
cut a swath of
destruction through the world to find an elf.
It's worse than that though. It's that the one particular elf has had part of the spell which they need to go back to their world inscribed on their body, and they only so they're going around stripping every elf they can find, and so
amazing.
It's literally every episode is them chasing a bunch of elves and trying to tear their clothes off and getting hit and
yeah, getting having the kya sort of
yeah.
thing.
That's like a comedy then, I'm guessing.
Yes, it's oh it's 100% like
yeah.
it's the like lowest common denominator, like making fun of the premise comedy. Because it's like, what if a bunch of psychopaths had a tank in like fantasy medieval world? So yeah, I mean, it was like the thing to watch because it's what's the vintage on Those Who Hunt Elves?
Oh,
I'm
doing me.
I was just it's 1997.
Sounds right.
Yeah, so it's almost exactly contemporary with Record of Lodoss War, Chronicles of the Heroic Knight, but it's just like, yeah, there's like bikini babes and they have like rocket launchers and they just blow a bunch of stuff up. It's
sounds amazing.
It's not very good. It's just trashy. It's kind of trashy.
You know, talking about how Record of Lodoss War was created, I was actually, when I was in Japan, guys, I was in Japan, if you didn't know, but we went to I went to a tabletop D&D based like shop, which was small, but there was like at least two rows full of just books that people have written, like a play by play account of the stuff that they've done, like Record of Lodoss War was, which I don't know, I found that really interesting that this stuff that over here we find is pretty recent and new is actually a thing that's been going on in Japan for ages.
Yeah, no. they've had Let's Plays forever, published Let's Plays. You can go to a store and buy
yeah.
someone else's like campaign record.
Yeah, exactly. And there was just like, it's like named series and like volumes of this book. And it's like, huh, that's really cool. I wish I could play that. And then there was also like odd like doujin board games based on Toho and stuff. And I was like, of course, there has to be. I want to play it now. I might buy it. And then I realized that I couldn't understand the rules, so I was like, ah, fuck it.
Yeah, I mean, I think only even they have a translation, I think, of Sword World 2.0, which is the new one, in a new setting there. But it's a weird system because polyhedral dice aren't that available, so it's all just like 2d6 is everything, and then they have like a like you can roll 2d6, and then you look on a table of results if they want a different if they don't want a different like probability curve. You have to like roll some dice and consult a table, so it's the very best of tabletop role playing, which is like flipping through a book to find a table to know what happened on the number you rolled on the dice.
Sounds amazing. Yeah, I did notice the lack of anything apart from a d6 when I was. Because they had, like, a whole display full of dice, and it was all D6, which was a bit disappointing, because I was hoping to get some cool D20s or something, but no.
Right, with, like, Japanese numbers on them or something.
Yeah, I mean, I have a set of that. My friend got me it, but it was made in Europe or something. He just bought it on Amazon for me.
There's a weird... I remember when I used to play Magic the Gathering fairly... frequently, that there was this weird cachet to people who had Japanese cards instead of English ones, and it was perfectly tournament legal, but it was always the guy who just comes in, oh yeah, full foil set of Japanese.
I imported this
perfect condition cards.
I mean, they're not, but they're the same card, right? It's literally just like conspicuous consumption.
Yeah, 100%. Occasionally with alternative artwork.
Oh my god! Yeah, Yu-Gi-Oh is also pretty bad for that, isn't it? Mm. I think Yu-Gi-Oh card art is a lot more sexier in Japan. But that's about all I know. I know nothing about Yu-Gi-Oh. Got to back away from that.
I mean, I think Yu-Gi-Oh! Has, this is mostly anecdotal, but I think that Yu-Gi-Oh! Has kind of a problem because they made the show first and then based the card game on the show, so the rules are just nonsensical, because a lot of that show is just like, oh, because you did that, I'm able to play these five cards at once.
Yeah.
And like, kids want to like do that. They want to go to the store and buy a bunch of cards and then be like, oh, and I have like 8 Blue Eyes White Dragons. I win.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that is true. They did make this show because, like, the manga starts off with like Yugi being a complete asshole, setting like a man's hand on fire with booze, and then it goes from that into card games, which is really fucking dumb. Also, I think one character, Kaiba, turns himself into a card and then plays himself.
Yeah, that happens.
Yeah.
They run out of ideas pretty rapidly.
This is already too much about Yu-Gi-Oh! Yeah. That I would like to...
Yeah, I caught you out, Andy, because you're like, oh, I don't know anything about Yu-Gi-Oh! And then you have all the, like, the most embarrassing parts of Yu-Gi-Oh! Memorized.
Only because I have diehard friends who love Yu-Gi-Oh! And tell me this stuff.
Yeah. Well, speaking of things that require specialist knowledge, Jeff and Duncan, I know that you've both been watching Degashikashi.
We have some stuff to talk about, so let's get stuck into it. Dig into it like as if it was some junk food, which transitions us into our first topic. Duncan, you wanted to introduce it?
I think you presented that somewhat the way Hotaru would. You just sort of ran into the room and just went, this is the topic now. This is what we're talking about. This obscure piece of candy, which I'm now going to lecture you on.
Yeah. And now everybody else is going, what the hell are you talking about?
We're talking about Degashikashi, which is a very junk food anime about junk food.
Yep. Just... directed by Satoshi Kawabara and produced by Studio Feel.
Yeah, so where do we begin with this? It's like, I think the first thing to talk about is its production design of its main heroine, Hotaru, who is literally,
almost literally out of, like, the main character, Kokonatsu, is a aspiring mangaka, and she's bears a striking resemblance to his fantasy girl, which is...
She's literally a fantasy fan service girl in goth getup.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the show from outside, she's the first thing which you see, and your impression will be coloured by that, for better or for worse. Honestly, in my case, for worse, in that I didn't assume that if you're that blatant about your fan service, you probably don't have all that much to say. And maybe it doesn't actually have that much to say, but it has a lot to talk about, which is a weird, weird combination. But if you want to have the history of Japanese sweets explained to you in the most crazed way by a almost cross-eyed,
cracked out junk food otaku.
Yeah, I think it's. I mean, the setup for her is she's supposedly like the daughter of this big snack food company, and she's decided that the only way she can become the best director of this company is by fully understanding junk food and by consuming it, and just
Yeah, and she just happens to be in this sleepy, unnamed Japanese village to recruit the father of the main male lead into working for her big candy zaibatsu for no particular reason. I think they say later on that, you know, first they say, oh, he's famous, but he's got sort of a floundering YouTube channel. And then later on, they just say that, oh, he's actually the most typical possible Degashi vendor imaginable, and that's why they want to bring him in.
I think it's almost like he's supposed to be almost like the icon of what it means to be one. Like, he's just like the personification of all these traits that you would assume you'd find in I think we should probably explain what these shops are. Mm-hmm. So they're not, certainly not something which exists in the West, I'd say.
Yeah, not really. They're little shops that sell a collection of candy and toys with primarily, you know, targeted at children. It's not like a general store like you would have like a 7-Eleven where, you know, most of the store is junk food, but then you also have some like sundry like staples and whatnot. This is just junk food wall to wall. And slightly gamified junk food too, because a lot of the candy is packed in with like, you know, light gambling elements where you can win more candy and things like that.
I think she explains at one point that part of what makes them this sort of subcategory of within snacks is this idea that they're designed for kids who don't have much money to spend. So instead of being large in quantity, they basically increase the life of a sweet that kid, the value of a sweet by making it a toy as well, or giving it some sort of function outside its taste.
So, yeah, and the name Degashi means actually, I think it means like nothing snack. Basically, it's you know, basically just junk food. It's sugar, it's chocolate, it's donuts. But yeah, it's packed in with this. You know, they try to make toys out of them. Actually, oddly enough, a friend of mine had brought back a couple of Japanese sweets, and I was actually very, very surprised by how elaborate some of them got. There was one that was, it came with a little plastic tray and seven different little packs of powder and very detailed instructions on how to deploy each one. So like, and like the tray was laid out in such a way that, you know, it was almost impossible to do it wrong, which is like perfect for little kids. So like the one tray had, you know, a slight depression in it, and it's like, okay, fill up that depression with water and then pour in pack number one, mix it up and let it rise. And it was just like this like fluffy rice kind of looking candy. And then it's like, you know, you put this, you know, yellow gelatin into one, and that became tamago, and you'd like pink into another one, and that became salmon, and you basically made this like little nigiri platter out of like sugary substances, like all just out of these little packets. And like, you know, it was like a good, you know, 15 minutes of activity with me and my son for this like, you know, 100 yen, you know, thing that otherwise, you know, if you bought that here, it was just like, you know, rip it open, chow it down, and that would be the end of it. And it was actually pretty fun.
Yeah, I mean, there's a surprising amount to get from to get about these things. As you say, it's like we are conditioned to think of snacks as just immediate gratification, just something to be wolfed down as quickly as possible. It's like just grab it and just devour it, or if it's the only snack you get for the entire morning or when you're a small kid, probably then just to make it last as long as possible. But these are as much activities as food. And
yeah,
I don't know. It's interesting the way they've actually, they built the cast, because it's basically a 3-person cast. The rest are, you've got Hotaru, Kokonatsu, and Saya. And outside those three, the rest sort of come in and out, but they are briefly characterized at best. And it's sort of like Saya runs a coffee shop, and I think there's like something going on with if like her being the sort of her affection for Kokonatsu and the way their relationship has actually developed and the way they have sort of mutual understandings about certain things is means that if there was any sort of actual sustainable long-term adult relationship to be formed, she'd be the sort of sober adult choice to make. And yet he longs for this just sugar lady.
Yeah.
And it's coffee versus sweets. It's like, that seems to be something... that seems to be a recurring theme in anime from FLCL and drinking... That switching from sweet to sour drinks and stuff. It seems to come up as one of those rites of passage into adulthood thing.
Yeah. And the nice thing about the show, though, is that it's, you know, much like a Degashi, it's a lot more complex than it really needs to be. And the relation, like, it's not your typical love triangle relationship where, you know, two girls are vying for one guy, because Hotaro's only true love is candy. Kokonuts, like, lusts after Hotaru, but has a genuine affection for Saya, and Saya is just very clearly crushing on Kokonuts. But Hotaro also has a great degree of respect for Saya, because she, you know, despite not really liking candy, she's extremely good at kids games and just schools everybody, whereas Hotaru is just chronically terrible at everything she does except explaining candy. And she starts describing, you know, referring to Saya as Sayashi, like Master Saya, and just has nothing but utmost respect for her. And there's like, you know, a good friendly relationship. Like there's no like female rivalry between them at all, which is, you know, it's refreshing. It's a very nice sort of warm bath of a show to get into. And, you know, it's almost the perfect, you know, not personification, but like animeification of the concept of junk food, which is not at all nourishing, but is also still a little bit satisfying.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a bad description of it. And I mean, as I say, I didn't come into it expecting much, but it is quite Moorish. And episodes are very easy to get through, and you start watching a series and soon you finish the series, and you're not entirely sure what you gained from that, but it's a pleasant enough experience itself.
Yeah, I definitely found that if I tried to watch more than a couple episodes at a time, I started getting really sick of it and kind of bored of it, because at the end of the day, it is a very shallow show. There isn't a lot to it, but at the same time, you still crave it the next day. Again, very much like junk food. And the first season, where there were full 22-minute episodes, each one broken up into, like, you know, two sub-stories, which each contain sort of a, you know, an A-plot and a B-plot, whereas the second season is just, like, a 15-minute show, it, you know, basically one half of the first episode, or of the, one half of an episode from the first season. And I think the format change is good. I do, you know, I find myself wanting more by the end of an episode of the second season, whereas by, you know, the end of this of an episode in the first season, I was just, you know, I was ready for it to be over. Yeah. Which, it's probably good. It's probably a good change.
Yeah, probably right overall. It's although I do think, like, the only thing I regret is that they didn't keep that the ED from the first series wasn't kept in some form, because that was weirdly catchy.
Yeah, yeah, the OP and the ED are both pretty good. I also really like the sort of little interstitial, like, Enso, and it was just, it's just like this, you know, a tableau that's on the screen for like just 2 seconds that really just kind of like jumped into the next season, which they kind of seem to have abandoned in the second season.
Yeah, it did work well, and just sort of like this, the pacing of it was, I think I've talked before, like, how shows like Working appeal to me because they sort of catch the same rhythm as the environment they're talking about, and in those little breaks, these little, and so sort of brought in, like, it was like confirmation of that it's meaningless. It's like, so we've just had this big dramatic thing, declaration from Hotaru, and then it's just, and so,
yeah,
moving on.
It is like just weird candy facts, as well as big titty candy girl
talking about weird things from Japan's cultural wastebasket. Why don't you?
That was exactly the transition that I was. That's exactly the transition I was going to go for. Speaking of Japanese garbage, Andy, what have you been watching?
I mean, I've been watching a lot of stuff. Stuff that I think we're going to hold off on talking, namely like Devilman Crybaby, Violet Evergarden, which is really good. But the thing that I'm talking to you guys today about is Pop Team Epic, or Popu Chepi Piku, which I still can't work out how that is Pop Team Epic in Japan, in Japanese. I think it's a joke, but I'm not quite sure.
Is there anything about this show which isn't a joke?
Yeah, I was going to say.
pretty much. It kind of is like a parody on itself. Like, I should start out, I don't adore this anime as much as you guys made out that I did in the last episode. I just don't despise it like John does. I enjoy it a lot. I think it's pretty good. I think it has this really nice sort of like pop punk sort of vibe to it, where every short is animated by different people, so they've not just got like one studio. It feels like they've got a bunch of different studios doing stuff, including like, and then on top of that you have just like different art styles in and of itself. So you've got the Boba Mimimiku, who's like this one guy who just draws this really ugly sort of gross art style, which kind of fits the show more than the original art style does. And then you've got these other guys, I can't remember their names, but they've made the characters out of wool. And then they sort of do dance songs. And one of them, the latest one, was like a one-to-one rendition of a weird foreigner song, I think, which was bizarre and obscure as a reference at all. And then there's like a French studio, like they just got a French animator to do it. And he introduces this like thing and be like, yeah, I made this. I hope you like it. And then some reason they don't translate it from French to English. So I'm just like, well, why? Why have you? But anyway, I guess because it makes the joke just as lost on the Japanese people as it
Japanese audience as it does the English audience. I guess they just managed to do it. But the show in and of itself is just a sketch show. It's the sketch show in the purest form that, like, everything is not related, but there is a sort of a setup, a punchline, and a joke done either, like, really quickly or over a certain... or over, like... about like 5 minutes, 5-10 minutes. Sometimes it can be like a minute and a half. I think the actual most of it is not is original content. A lot of the bits that aren't original content are like the 4-panel Pop Team Epic stuff, which I personally find quite funny. I think it's pretty clever that they managed to get these what feel like non sequiturs, what feel like random pulls, to actually sort of work in its own internal logic, and I think that that is maybe a lot harder than it people led it on to be. Like, if you look at the Mighty Boosh, this is now, like, I don't know whether Ben's heard of the Mighty Boosh.
I know what the Mighty Boosh is, thank you, Andrew.
I don't know, like, it's a weird show. Like, not a lot of people like it in America, but I don't know whether it really made it, because I think it was considered too weird for American taste.
Too weird.
I think
for
it
America.
Was presented poorly.
Did you like it, Duncan?
Meh.
Moving on.
Yeah. Well, I thought that, like, you look at the Mighty Boosh as an example, that comedy feels very, like, random and sort of scattershot and weird and, like, crazy and trippy and all that kind of stuff. But actually, the great thing about the Mighty Boosh is there is an internal logic, and then there is an internal lore that keeps it grounded to reality, that makes the extra sensory, the ridiculous stuff more funny, which then comparing that to Noel Fielding's other works after the Boosh, you're like, yeah, okay, he really needed grounding by Julian Barrett.
Yeah, he did.
Otherwise, because without him, it's just like, oh, I'm in a space cooking shoes because it's so wacky and funny. And you're just like, yeah, that's not funny. There was a beautiful pairing in the Mighty Boosh that I felt is missing from everything he's done. But that's not what we're here to talk about.
Is there Okay, so you've obviously reached into contemporary Western comedy for equivalents. Is there a... what would, for instance, distinguish Pop Team Epic from another... let's think, what's another good sketch example? Something like, I don't know, Otsumatsu, or even that holiest of holies, Setsubou Senshi.
See, yeah, that's what I want to know, because a lot of the, like, stuff that Pop Team Epic's been doing as part of its, like, Kuso anime, like, shitposting aesthetic, has been, like, already done in Science of Sensei. They have different art styles and a lot of different sequences. They switch voice actors around, which I know that Pop Team Epic does too.
That Pop Team Epic takes that to the next degree by making, well, I say the next degree, I think they're just making it on the cheap. They've done it. They clearly wanted it as a short, and then in my head, they've realized that the people have produced it, booked it as a 30-minute episode. So what they've done is they replay the whole thing. And I don't know whether it's like straight after the advert break. They replay the whole thing with different voice actors. And it's been that since episode one. So the second part are always different voice actors from the first part. And then the first part has the same voice actors of who play Popuko and Pipimi. I think that's their names. And then the second half are always different voice actors doing, like, their roles, which is good if you're like, I really like these voice actors. But if you're not, then there's apart from one episode, there's no difference in the actual content.
I like to think that there was like a weird mixed up at birth thing where Degashi Kashi 2 got a half length episode and episode slot, and Pop Team Epic got the full length episode slot, and they're like, well, let's just roll with it. So,
yeah. I think that
I haven't seen Sayonara Zetsubou Sensei, which I know hurts you, Ben.
That's fine.
I can't. Not out of
it's
any
not
reason.
Fine. You can tell. It's really not fine. The look in his eyes, the tone of his voice.
I'm smiling. What are you guys talking about?
That smile hides something, Ben.
That smile hides like a dead, emotionless body. He's like, it's fine.
What are you talking about? This is my best Nakamura smile.
I can't comment about Sayonara Zetsubou Sensei. As far as Osomatsu-san goes, the difference in the parodies is that Osomatsu-san will take a parody over a whole episode or a joke over the whole episode, whilst Pop Team Epic does about 30-minute to a minute skits. So that is really like, if you don't like this bit, don't worry, because in a minute something else will happen and you will like that, probably. And I think the actual closest thing that this could be linked to is Gag Manga Biori. Gag Manga Biori. Yes.
That's the name.
Yeah, if you guys watch that, I think that's probably the closest thing that this show could be related to. Sort of a bit crude, a bit like quite funny. Well, I find it funny. I know it's not everyone's cup of tea, but I find it really quite funny. It's quite crude, it's quite funny, and it's just got like shorts, and but difference is that Gag Manga Biori is a 5-minute long episode, whilst Pop Team Epic is 30 for whatever reason. You could also draw comparisons to Robot Chicken.
Weirdly, you describing it made me think of that.
Yeah, Robot Chicken's like a pretty good pull, actually. I think the more I watch it, I'm like, yeah, this is quite a lot like Robot Chicken, but Robot Chicken does a lot of like pop culture references, and Pop Team Epic is more about like memes and other sort of like odd, like not necessarily like parodying. They're not always parodying a thing like Robot Chicken is. Like, Robot Chicken's always parodying, like, either like Mario, Star Wars, this. Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah, mostly.
Yeah, they're mostly just, like, all current nerd pop culture stuff, so.
Yeah, or if you want an even deeper pull, the Adam and Joe show. I don't know whether anyone knows that.
Sorry, no.
No, that's a long time ago.
Oh, I know, but... Yeah. Man, it's one of my favorites. I love Adam and Joe. I would say that I really enjoy it. The first episode I thought wasn't as good as the second episode. The first episode went a bit too deep in its referencing, like that one clip where they just did a bunch of references to everything in like 30 seconds. I felt the second episode got away from that. And it's not been so reference heavy since, although there have been some pretty good, like, odd crossover referencing with, like, the good references are the references that aren't just like that first episode, which was just like, this bit's Skyrim. It's funny because you know that Skyrim. This bit's like your name, your name. It's funny because you know it's your name. The latest episode had a pretty good, like, odd referencing thing where it was trying to reference, like, 20 different anime in the same space, but you could just about sort of pick them up, and it made me laugh, and at the end of the day, that's all it's trying to be. It's just trying to make people laugh, and it works for me quite a lot.
The last question I'd have for you about it would be, do the two main characters actually have any character to them, or are they basically just puppets there to just make the jokes? They don't actually have any characteristics, or are they just like basically there to spit out the punchlines?
I mean, it's kind of a bit mix of both. Again, this is the thing which I think falls with the with whoever's studio is animating it. I think usually Popuko is sort of like the more abrasive, sort of like the internal logic that just wants you to be the most aggressive, angry person and tells someone to shut the fuck up and all that kind of stuff. Whilst Mimi Pipi Me, is sort of
the one who's sort of like either the voice of reason or is sort of, you know, the one that tells her to calm down. Usually,
so
sort
of angry and straight man, basically.
Yeah, I was going to ask if it is like the Boke Tsukome dynamic or if it's something different.
It's totally that, although I think, I don't know, it is that. And a lot of the times that, yeah, they are mostly puppets to sort of incorporate other jokes. Like, they themselves do not have much of a personality. But I don't personally see that as a bad thing. They're just, it's just a sketch show. It's a sketch show in the purest form of a sketch show. And I personally really dig it. I really love it. And I think that if you don't bother watching the second half, just watch the first half. Or if you'd rather just listen to different voice actors every time, just watch the second half and enjoy it. The only good difference was the second episode, where there's a bit of ad-libbing, and that was actually quite a funny change, because they then shot, there was like, the whole setup was that it was like there was meant to be like a pilot, so they're doing like the voice acting, and then the Popoko and PPMe came in and told them that they're all shit at their jobs, and then it cut to like a live recording of the voice actors in the studio, like just like talking about the script, and that to me was quite funny. That was like, that went like broke the fourth wall in really amusing ways, and then the second half, they changed that. So that's the only one that I should say you'd probably bother watching. Otherwise, I've just skipped them all. Pop Team Epic, it's good. I really don't understand why people might be against it. I think...
I think what I got from John was that he found some of its attempts to be irreverent were punching down.
I mean, I don't know how much of that is in the translation, because that the excerpts that he has shown us is fan translations, not official translations. And I think that I wonder if Pop Team Epic gets an official translation, I doubt they'll use such inflammatory words just to get a rise out of you.
I think most of the black backlash that I've been seeing happen is just the idea that it's kind of the sort of like aimless punching everywhere punk aesthetic that is kind of almost Channer or Redditor sort of outlook. And I think even it's actually been funny that some of the harshest criticisms I've seen have been from like occasionally peeking in on 4chan or Reddit's anime board. Because some people love it and think that it's a show made exactly for them, and some people see it as like a compromised or co-opted aspect of like, you know, Nichan culture or whatever.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's not what I'm interested in at all, so haven't really been paying attention. But
no, I think that that's a good comparison. It's a very like 2chan sort of. Show through and through, and there's definitely like, well, when I've been watching it with Mids have been like, I can't believe that they just stole that straight from 2chan. And some of those there are which again I think boils down to the studio that are doing the certain animation at the time. There are some bits that are just doing that, they're just stealing 2chan jokes or stealing 2chan memes, but then there's also other stuff that isn't doing that quite a lot, and I think that they're just as good. I understand their ire, and I can get it, but personally, that doesn't bother me. I just enjoy it. I don't think it's amazing. I should just clarify, like, there are problems with it. When a joke doesn't land, it doesn't land. A lot of the stuff is sort of, like, impressive visually. Like, there's some very nice, like, 32-bit art that's been going on, which I really enjoy, which are all just video game references, and it's not funny, but I appreciate it. I also think that, but again, you're talking about openings. The opening to Pop Team Epic is amazing. I would really recommend you at least go and search for that, because it's awesome. And it starts with like a TV and then a baseball bat with nails in it, smashing it. And it's just like, it just captures what Pop Team Epic is trying to be, which is what you said, like punk. it's trying to be very punk, like punk comedy. And personally, for me, it works. But not for everybody, which is fine. I think that's
nothing. Speaking
wrong
with of that. Things which work for you, Andy, and not for everyone else, this week I've been watching Kimono Friends.
Yes. So, best anime of last year.
Let's talk this. Let's talk about this. So, well, where do we even begin? So,
I mean, do you want to mention why you watched Kimono Friends in the first place?
Well, yeah. Let's talk about its most obvious thing, the thing you will notice from the very moment you start watching it, which is that it has some of the most ugly CGI. Uh-huh. Characters ever uh-huh. created.
I don't know about that. I mean, Ajin had some pretty ugly CG animation.
I mean, it's still impressive. But let's just contextualize what it is first. It's a, on the surface anyway, about the friends who are sort of animal human hybrids,
yeah.
And which inhabit this sort of deserted, semi rundown park, and one
called
of them
Japari
several,
park.
Yeah, helping a young girl make her way to the library to find out what she is and where the rest of her tribe, family, whatever, have gone.
Well, yeah, it starts off with who she is, because every time someone is born in this planet, which is when a spirit touches the what was it called, the something stone in the center of the island, yes. they get born, and there is kind of like Noah's Ark, there is, but with one fewer, there's one of every animal in this island. So when she was born, she had to be an animal of something. So they go off and try and find out what animal she is. Yeah. And it turns out, surprise, surprise, that she's a human, which is the best thing. Yeah.
And so its second level is that the park is basically a disaster area,
yes.
Where some sort of weird AI has gone crazy. And has mm-hmm. basically. Have you ever, either of you ever read the book Blood Music?
No.
No. So it's okay, so it's almost like the way I've read it, it is this show is essentially that the Cerulean's, these weird little alien things, are basically nanobot swarms. So that's why you get these weird human-animal hybrids. You've just got these little nanomachines going out, mixing things together. And it's essentially an island which has been overrun by grey goo, which doesn't entirely know what it's doing. And yeah. So you've got this almost post-apocalyptic park. Mm-hmm. And so that's the sort of second reading. The third reading, which is what I'm going to be... the level further.
I mean, this is what's interesting about Kimono Friends, is that there are these levels. When you first start off, you're like, what is this cutesy bullshit? But the fact that they've pulled out so many of these levels, I think, is quite kind of amazing. But carry on.
Just that you can read this into it.
Oh, but I think it's almost certainly purposefully put in. Like, these levels are definitely meant to be there.
Yeah. I mean, the reading I have it...
Wait, what's the third, level? What's the third level?
Which is that... So, if you look at the friends, they very, very much resemble, in both the way they are animated and in the way they're styled, is mascots. They're basically...
Yes,
and
I know.
And their relationship to each other is like employees. They're very much all like just workers. They're almost like salary women and men in the park. And they even have the boss, that this little AI tour guide who wanders around and has like got, he's always got like a collar almost.
Yeah, he is the collar. He's not the robot. He's the collar.
Oh yeah, that's what turns out, isn't it? Yeah, that's the reveal in the final episode. along with a giant, like 80-foot tall big dog, which is turns out to be the final form of the
yeah, which they then Triffid style lure into the sea.
Yeah. But what I ended up basically taking away from it is that in some weird way, this is actually a comment not on any sort of weird environmental thing, but actually on work. And that it's basically that it's like mascots are from like this previous era where companies had like responsibilities to their employees where you were actually proud of whoever represented your company or whatever. And so there's this weird idea that if you were part of that generation, you had like this, you worked for this company, you had a job for life, you retired, all this, that, the other. But what's happened with our generation is as globalization has come along, all that's gone. Everything has all the certainties of which came with sort of the second industrial revolution have been wiped away by the third. That all this loyalty to company and all that has just become gone. So what mascots mean nothing now because the company has no loyalty to you, so you have no loyalty to the company. Right. And so you have no family. You have what all these people who feel incredibly divorced from the rest of society and don't really have a place in it. And it's like, is this what you're actually doing? Probably not, but I can read this into you. And
yeah, that's a deep reading, but I can see that. I think the reason why they all kind of look like mascots, which I can see, they totally do, it's because it's drawn probably by, I can't remember the artist, but the artist who did Sergeant Frog. And her art style is very, like, kind of cutesy, but then sort of not cute enough to sort of be a failed experiment.
But do you see, yeah, it's like, in a weird way, that's why I'm okay with the terrible animation style in the end, because it feels right for, you know how mascots are these incredibly weird things where there's someone inside the suit and they don't entirely move properly, and yeah, if you start thinking of the Kimono Friends things as that, that's absolutely terrible. That's exactly how a mascot would move.
I mean, the reason behind that is because it was done on less than a shoestring budget,
to say the least.
There's other stuff though, like Gouda Gouda. What is it?
Gouda Gouda Fairies,
or like straight title robot anime. There is like a lineage of just kind of like cheaply animated CG comedies that have kind of like improv heavy jokes in them.
Yeah, but Kimono Friends isn't improv heavy. Gouda Gouda Fairies is pretty funny, but it's all done because they record it and then they probably animate it within a week. I think that with Kimono Friends, you've got a studio that got at the time failing IP that a month before, like probably during them making the show, the mobile game closed, the online net game closed down. So there was no actual reason to make it because there was no interest for this series all of a sudden. So the company could pretty much have free reign on this license. And they did. I felt, I don't know, I'm partly joking, like, but partly serious, kind of in love with this show in a way that is actually more genuine than me being a troll. Like,
it's just like they've got all these assets, and it's okay. So what should we do with this?
Well, yeah. I mean, it hasn't. Like, I didn't realize just how little budget they were on when they started it. The director animated most of it. They didn't have a wheel. They didn't have enough time to animate a wheel moving until about episode 4, which is hilarious to me. And yet they managed, like, just, I guess purely by the love that people have poured it and the effort that people have poured into this show, they've managed to make something that's incredible and sort of taken, people have gotten a lot out of it.
I think some of the voice actresses were actually fairly good as well. I was actually surprised by that.
Yeah, I think some of them actually are. But, like, I think the Peppa Poos, the penguins, they're all reasonably new. I think that yeah, you're right. There's a few vets, but I don't think any massive ones. I mean, I don't have the
I quite enjoyed.
Friends.
Yeah.
It's okay. I've been quietly looking it up, so I'll jump in with anything cool, but we don't want to play the usual game we play.
I was going to say, I quite enjoyed the Serval's performance. It was just like, yeah, she's just going to just be incredibly ditzy, and she's not going to attempt to do any nuance at all. It's just pure sugar.
Yeah, but they're all kind of ditzy. Like, it's interesting. Like, they are kind of robotic in that way of, like, they have an area, and they stay in that area, and they don't leave.
Yeah, they've got that task they do in the area.
And the reason why Serval is even following Caban-chan is because now she has a task to help Caban-chan go and find out who she is. And then a friendship kind of forms from that. It's weird. I also find that the characterizations of every character, like, it really sticks with you, and it's really funny, and it's really enjoyable. And, like, Arai-san and Fennec-san, the Raccoon-san and Fennec-san, who are, like, the weird, like, lackeys that are trying to catch up with Serval and Caban-chan.
Yeah, the punchline is that they've just been chasing her hat.
Yes. Like, that whole thing, like, they are probably some of, like, my favourite characters, just because they're so dumb, but they play off each other so well. And it's interesting. I don't think that season two, I don't know if you'll watch season two, Duncan, but I don't think
for the hell
be,
of it.
I mean, I probably will, just, but I know it's not going to capture or be as good as what the first season is, because they've lost the studio and it's all fallen to shit. Purely because of a horse racing anime, like that episode that you've probably watched. You don't know one where they go to.
They lost the studio on the horses.
Yeah, no, they really did. They agreed to make that. There's one episode at the end which feels very out of place, where it's just them going to a horse racing. It's even a horse racing stable and, like, stadium and everything, but completely empty. And then they are sitting there and, like, talking to horses. That was done as a promo for horse racing. That wasn't approved by Kadokawa. I believe this is how it all started. And Kadokawa wasn't having any of it. And because of that, Yozora were kicked out. Oh no, not Yozora. What are they called? I can't remember what they're called. But yeah. So that's why they're not in the second season anymore.
Yoyorozu,
yeah. But it's, I mean, I'm glad. Did you enjoy it out of interest?
Yeah, it was easy watching. It was not, grating in the way I expected it to be.
Did you find yourself caught up in it at all, or were you just like, this is
not
just
really caught up, but just like, it was, as I say, very easy watching. It's like, just have it on in the background, sort of as a second screen, sort of have it in the corner of my eye watching it. Occasionally a bit will interest me in, oh yeah, okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
Okay, back, yeah.
that's great. That's pretty much all they really wanted, I'm guessing. It meant the only reason that you watched it anyway is because I had to watch, I think, something that we'll be talking about after the break.
Indeed, it was a equivalent exchange to...
equivalent exchange for me to watch the utter garbage that I have just finished watching. So
Yeah, I think, should we take a break and then
talk about that? We'll talk about how one man's trash is another man's treasure after the break. When we discuss our spotlight, Flowers of Evil. And we're back. As promised, for the second half, we'll be discussing our spotlight anime, Flowers of Evil, a 2013 anime directed by Nagama Hiroshi, based on a manga that ran from 2009 to 2014 by Oshimi Shuzo. I know that this is an anime that Jeff picked and Duncan pitched, so hopefully they can tell us some about that.
So, Flowers of Evil. This is a show about being a teenager and making all the wrong choices for all the wrong reasons with all the wrong people. And more specifically, it's about a young man called Kasuga who lives in a small rural town, and every day he walks to school through this decaying, rundown Nowhereville, and every day he consoles himself that he's special because he reads The Flowers of Evil, a book of poetry by Baudelaire, and he's convinced himself that this is why he's different, this is why he can understand this, and so that means he's different, he's not just part of this rotting little nowhere town. And that's something everyone goes through to a certain extent. Everyone wants to believe themselves special, especially as a teenager. Mm-hmm. But where that leads him and how disastrously he lets that desire to be special overrule everything else is what appeals to me about this show. That's why I pitched it.
And the reason I picked it, at the time I was very interested in watching shows. Like, typically my anime fandom has been a lot of, like, you know, the standard action fare. I've always kind of shied away from, you know, touchy-feely kind of high school kids who are sad kind of shows, unless those high school kids subsequently got into giant robots and fought things. And I thought, you know, this would be a good change of pace. Like, I wouldn't normally pick something like this on my own. I certainly wasn't expecting what I got, but I really, really, really liked it. And I guess we should go into a summary of the plot. It's relatively simple. Kasuga is, as you were saying, you know, an awkward, alienated kid, you know, sort of still figuring himself out, has taken on, you know, this internal persona of this, you know, tortured, sensitive soul. He has projected onto a girl in his class, Seiki, this impossible to fill role of just being his muse and his angel, who he has to worship from afar because he's such a dirtbag that he could never, you know, be with her. And he just, you know, he just tortures himself this way to make himself feel special, until one day when he is on his own in the classroom, he has a sudden impulse to steal her gym clothes. He's sort of surprised in the act, runs off with them. It's a completely impulsive act, which he just immediately regrets, and plans to, you know, just sneak it back like it never happened. But unfortunately for him, he was caught in the act by the class sort of ne'er-do-well Nakamura, who, she is, you know, similarly to him, sort of a nothing entity in the class, but she is completely antisocial in a whereas Kasuga is more of just sort of asocial. You know, he has a clique that he hangs out with, but she is alone, and she alienates everybody very intentionally. And
yeah, she has no desire not to be alone.
Mm-hmm. However, mostly because she thinks everybody else around her are boring and rotting, just like the town is, and she doesn't want anything to do with the town or them until she sees Kasuga, you know, in his impulsive act stealing these gym clothes, says, aha, here somebody is messed up as I am. I'm going to have a fellow traveler now. I just have to convince him that this is the best thing to do. And she begins blackmailing him into basically humiliating himself, forcing him to wear the gym clothes, forcing him to basically, you know, rub his nose into the things that he's done.
Hmm.
And telling him, you know, you are going to embrace this. You are just like me. You just need to realize it. And then later on, it's interesting because Seiki also becomes involved with him, specifically because there is a minor classroom controversy. Somebody's money goes missing, and people just start deciding that, oh, it must have been Nakamura because she's an asshole. Nobody likes her, so she must be a thief. And Kasuga, you know, he knows for a fact that she didn't do it because she's been after him, tormenting him. And so he knows, like, oh, you know, it wasn't her, and he sticks up for her. You know, he doesn't really go into why, obviously, but everybody's like, oh, you like her, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, no, fuck you, screw off. But then Seiki, you know, sees in him this noble soul, which, you know, she sees a kindred spirit, and she says, you know, and she starts pursuing Kasuga and wanting to know more about him. And it's interesting because the three people, like, you know, the three main characters of the show all are completely wrong about each other, but all are convinced that they have a better understanding of this person than they do.
Hmm.
Yeah, my favorite quote actually was near the end when he's confessing his awfulness to the two girls in his, like, weird love triangle in the rain, where he says, and I quote, this is an actual quote, I don't actually understand Baudelaire or Flowers of Evil. I was just impressed with myself for reading it. I was trying not to see who I really was, didn't want to accept that I wasn't special. I am an empty person.
That was my favorite scene, actually, of the whole thing.
It's a really good scene.
Just him acknowledging that he's an empty person. Just really, that was like the only part of it that I actually enjoyed, I think. The rest of it, couldn't give two fucks about. I didn't understand his motivations throughout most, if not all of it. And I just was...
Okay, so let's go in straight away on not understanding his motivations.
Yeah, I've got thoughts there, definitely.
So you start off, Ben.
Sure. I mean, I think that Kasuga is very lonely, but I think that he's done the typical teenage boy thing of, like, deciding that him being lonely and misunderstood is what makes him special. And so even though he constantly pretends that he wants Saiki to understand him, he's much more happy with Nakamura because she doesn't care about understanding him and she just enjoys abusing him. It's like he really is hiding from himself, even though he has all these romantic pretensions of, like, having a true soul connection to somebody. He thinks that he wants the intense intimacy that he finds represented in Flowers of Evil, but he doesn't want that. He wants to be special and in this boring town where he doesn't even really believe there's an outside world at one point, he said. He's like, I think maybe there's nothing over those mountains.
No, he doesn't say that. Nakamura does.
Doesn't she? Doesn't he say that too?
Nakamura says it.
Nakamura's...
Maybe he
Nakamura
agrees
does,
with her.
Yeah. Nakamura says that, and he sort of reflects that. She says it's him, and he apes it at one point.
But I don't think that's what he believes. I think that's just him repeating something that he finds...
But that's him. He's like
this, shallow.
He's like you throw this thing at him, and he goes, "Oh yeah, that this new revelation is what I'm now going to base my entire life around." It's like yes, 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 yes. There's nothing over this mountain. You're right, Nakamura. It's like, no.
Yeah, because she's like everyone's disgusting maggots. He's like, yeah, disgusting maggots. I guess I'm into that. Like, this is the guy who wants to belong so much that he fucking wears a gym suit under his, like, just tell her to fuck off.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He eventually does. And it's he's so sad and so lonely and so desperate for a connection, but so afraid of what that connection would mean about him that he just is this pathetic, shallow boy that feels very authentic to being 15 and being full of yourself in a very strange, sad way, for me at least.
I think everybody of a certain age, if you were into anime, is somebody like Kasuga. Like, yeah. A lot of the things that attract me to this show are the things that attracted me to Evangelion when I was in my late teens. Like, you know, I could just, you know, it's one of those shows where, you know, you, at a certain point in your life, you're like, oh, that's me. And then later on in your life, you're like, oh, that was me.
Yeah. Or that could have been me.
Yeah.
Because, as it, yeah, it's like, with the ED and that text to speak rendition of this, I don't know if it's actually one of Baudelaire's poems or anything, or if it's just a random set of phrases they came upon, but I noticed they were actually weirdly scattered amongst the dialogue, some of them. And I wondered that about Nakamura, for instance. Are they implying that she's actually far, not necessarily smarter, but far more, she's read this book, she just doesn't give a damn about it, she hasn't even considered it of worth, and it's like Psyche's tried really hard to read it, and it's just read it time and time again, and just can't make any connection with it, finds it baffling.
Because like what I was saying before, like I think that like Nakamura is what Kasuga pretends to be, that she doesn't need to read Baudelaire to like create this persona. It's just that's who she is. She is this, like, you know, deeply hedonistic, deeply alienated person who feels, you know, basically no empathy to anybody who isn't exactly like herself. And anybody who she thinks could be like her, she tries to, you know, she tries to force them to become like her. You know, she's trying to reproduce. She's trying to spread, you know, her evil, like, as if it was a blooming flower. And that's, you know, that's part of what Kasuga finds so attractive in her, is that, you know, she is this darkness that he pretends to have.
Yeah.
If she had read that book, like, she multiple times, she like slaps it out of his hand, she like smears it in his face, like she just has utter disdain for this, you know, this fetishized idea of the thing that she is. You know, she's almost saying to him, like, you know, it's right here in front of you. You know, you don't need this book. You know, he says, like, this book. No, there's a scene early in the series where she basically demands that, you know, you have to write me an essay about, you know, all of your dirty thoughts. And he tells her, you know, oh, you know, this book is me. This book, Flowers of Evil, is me. And she slaps it out of his hand and says, I don't want this book. I want you. I want you to tell me who you are.
It's hard to tell because we don't really get much of a look inside Nakamura's head. She's very closed off. And even when he goes into her room, which, you know, like has literally, like, symbolically goes and I said literally, but I meant symbolically. I hate that. When he symbolically goes inside her head by going into a room, opening a drawer and pulling out her journal, it doesn't really tell us anything new about, like, we learn that, like, everything that Nakamura seems on the surface, she at least presents as being her inner life. But one of the amazing things about both the performance of the person who physically was Nakamura and the way they rotoscoped her is that she just has this, like, blank cow-like face for so much of the anime where you can't even, like no one's really very expressive. That's one of the downsides of the art style. But Nakamura especially, like, has nothing going on in her head just from what you look at her face. And, like, it looks like confidence, and I think that's what Kasuga ultimately is attracted to with her, is that she, like, doesn't give a shit. Like, she, like, she's doing her own thing. But I do think, like, we never, as an audience, never get inside her, or at least only get inside her with brief glimpses when when Casca is something that's so unexpected that she doesn't know how to react or can't react by just calling him a shithead pushing him down.
It's interesting you bring up the writing because I hadn't thought about it before, but like when he's chasing after her with his little, he's got like an essay almost, like page upon page.
That was
page.
So cringy. Oh.
And yet,
she's got such sort of confidence in her own ideas that she just, all she needs to write down is these couple of phrases and that's it. She doesn't feel any need to put it out on the page because she's just got it in there.
Maybe it's sort of like an educational bluntness that she doesn't know how else to describe her feelings. She's always been portrayed as not the cleverest person in class.
Yeah,
I think in some ways, early on, Nakamura's, the way we see her attitude towards him, it's almost inhuman. Like, she almost doesn't see him as the same species as her. Like, it's like she sees herself as something apart from every other human. Yeah. Whereas he sees himself as a sort of exceptional human. And what she wants him to do is to just, she sees this sort of thing, this moment in him where, well, maybe there's something about him which is closer to what I am than to what all these other people are.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, because he sees himself as being an exceptional sinner who needs to be redeemed, whereas she sees him as, you know, she wants him to just reject his humanity and embrace the sin. And like, I don't know if it's cool these days to diagnose fictional characters with real mental issues, but throughout the show, Nakamura struck me as basically an undiagnosed sociopath.
Mm.
Like, she seemed like all of her affection towards Kasuga is hinged on, I have found somebody to, you know, I have found a fellow traveler, I have found somebody to share my life with, I just need to convince him that that is also the case. I've seen this thing in him, and I want that to be, you know, I want him in my life so that, you know, I can more comfortably just, like, leave everybody else behind. Whereas he, you know, he enjoys the attention because he, you know, she sees something exceptional in him that he desperately, you know, he desperately wants to be seen as exceptional. And so this attention is somewhat intoxicating for Kasuga.
Yeah.
I don't know. Because I was wondering at the beginning, like, oh, is he going to fall for, like, the weird, like, brutish bully girl? And he kind of does, but also kind of doesn't. Like, nothing freaks him out about Nakamura more than when she's interested in him. But if she's not, then he writes writes an 8-page essay and tries to read it to her while she runs down the street, like the biggest tool in the world. Ugh. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's just grasping at straws in a way that, like, this person truly understands me. But she doesn't. They're all trying to understand each other. And, like, Nakamura is the single most interesting person in that whole show. And they don't delve into her character at all. I imagine that they will delve into it a lot in the manga afterwards.
I disagree. Yeah. I think when you meet her father, like, I think that's when you start to get Nakamura, because he's a very interesting character, I thought.
See, I disagree. I thought that was interesting in and of the fact that I was expecting a shit show. I was expecting some sort of, like, abusive father thing.
Yeah.
But no, it was a rundown father who has been treated, had a divorce for whatever reason, and then has tried to, like, raise this child like the best of his ability, but as he's a family man, as he's, you know, working, he can't. And I find that incredibly tragic, and I thought that was kind of a great thing as well, because he wasn't, they were a normal family. Like, this is a show with normal family units that you don't see in anime, which in itself is a great thing.
Well, yeah, seeing Kasuga's, like, mother and father, like, try to figure out, like, what's his problem, and the mom, like, they do like kind of a good cop, bad cop thing. She's like, where is he? Where have you been? And and the dad's like, oh, he's just going through that age. And that was very good. But like, I liked Nakamura's father, who I guess is also Nakamura, because that's a last name. but you spend the whole anime scene like you said, like, what the fuck is wrong with her family? Like, are they like abusive? Are they absent? And it's just like a dad who's kind of like seems maybe a little like depressed and antisocial, but is perfectly normal. And he's just like, yeah, I don't know what's wrong with her. And you don't get an answer. And I think that's like we expect there to be like, oh, here's the key to why she's such a freak. And it's like, no, you don't get to like read one book of poetry and be special. You don't get to like meet someone's parents, understand them because of that. I felt it was very in keeping with the show.
Yeah. And the fact that, you know, towards the end, Kasuga eventually rejects Seki for, you know, just being a person and also just out of his own self-loathing, and then sort of transforms his fixation onto one of, you know, wanting to fix Nakamura. He realizes that, you know, oh, I've been torturing myself with this illusion of my own terribleness, but she's seriously alone. Like, she is the thing that I thought I was, and I can save her, which, again, is just a completely self-destructive impulse. You know, he...
Yeah, I agree. It's him. It's basically all about him finding a place and wanting a place and not realizing that that place is right in front of him. He has, at the beginning, he has friends, he has a family that loves him, he has friends that are good friends. Sure, they don't, like, he says that they don't understand him, but then they do understand him. They understand that he thinks that he's better than them. There's this sort of, like, he's, I mean, I kind of want to say Chunibyoism, like, he wants...
No, I think that's good, yeah.
Yeah, he wants to be something that he isn't, and he can never be, and... That is why that last episode, that second to last episode, is so great, because it's that fundamental understanding that he isn't anybody. But then again, like, he needs to realize, he hasn't realized that it's him reading the book. So even if he thinks like, oh, I don't really like this book, I just read it like it because I felt special. Like, that is his character.
That whole sequence, it was Psyche's stuff, which I really liked. Like, she's like, I've read this book, I've read it time and time and again, and I just do not get it at all. I don't understand it, I don't like it, but I want to know you. And, like, it's a really heartfelt, human thing to say, like, I just want to understand you, I don't. And yet he's like, no, you're being a human.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the cool thing about Psyche, is that, like, she's the nightmare for Kasuga, even though, like, she's as perfect, supposedly as perfect woman as he sets her up early on, because like, she just wants to understand him, and she's like, I know you stole my uniform, cool, explain to me why, and like, and I'll meet you halfway. And he's like, oh no.
Yeah, I mean, that was like I went to Vince after watching that. I was like, honey, if I stole your gym uniform, would you forgive me? He was like, no, you fucking weirdo, fuck off. Like, Psyche is like an unbelievably nice person.
And this dynamic between the three of them, because Seki just, she just wants to get to know him. Like, she, you know, she's very innocent. She's not, she's just a normal person who is also, you know, somewhat lonely, wants to have a friend. Just, you know, she just thinks she's, you know, he's a normal, decent guy, and has no idea of this grand drama that's going on between Nakamura and Kasuga. And, you know, a lot of the tension of the show is Kasuga trying desperately to hide this from her until he can't. At which point, Seki goes, oh, huh, that's kind of fucked, but we could work through this. Like, you know, this is just a thing. And at that point, he, you know, his his illusions are shattered, and all of a sudden she's just a person. And that, you know, almost becomes as repulsive to him as his own, you know, jumped up idea of his own sin.
Yeah, because I think there's this whole thing that until that point when she accepts him, well, it's not even she accepts him, she accepts that there's a journey they could make together, and that's something which she keeps getting emphasized, that their relationship is a journey. And
yeah, it's something to build.
And there's uncertainty within that of whether it will be ever be fully built or where it will lead to. But what Nakamura offers is certainty. And it's that... There's so many times where that's echoed. It's like there's two scenes in different parts of this series. What where Nakamura and Saiki both come outside his room and try and get his attention. And when Nakamura comes to his house, she just throws rocks at his window until he and just sort of orders him to come down almost. Whereas Saiki tries to reason with him, tries to talk to him, and there's like a moment when that he is responsible for all that had been going on is revealed to them, and afterwards she asks Nakamura what's the relationship you have with him, and Nakamura's answer is we made a contract. And she says it in such a way that it's like, you don't have any answer for this. This is something you couldn't understand, and this is something which is certain and real, whereas you're just this lost person sort of scraping at the mud trying to get somewhere, whereas we have this certainty of destination, and I'm going to take him there.
But he also... is just telling himself over and over again, no, no, I have to fight this. I have to be better than this. I have to be better for Seki.
I also think that there's a sort of thing where he reads Flowers of Evil and he sort of gets this notion of pure evil, gets this notion of, if you want a disgusting D&D term, chaotic evil. And he likes that as an idea, and then what he's presented with Nakamura is someone who embodies that idea of evil, and I think he gets kind of intoxicated by the
evil. He very much gets intoxicated.
I like they're all, it's three extremely lonely people who have these kind of antithetical coping strategies that just all make each other nervous, because we have like the closed off bully and we have the introspective elitist, and then we have like this girl who just like is just reaching out for someone. Yeah, and I read your dumb book, and it doesn't make sense to me, so like sit down and tell me about it. And he's like, and rather than have to explain why he loves a book, he says he doesn't understand it and he's just been showing off.
But I think that is his reason. I think that is a legitimate reason to enjoy a book or to enjoy like a piece of art, is because you understand it while someone else doesn't, and that gives you elitism. Like, yeah. I think that is a perfectly fine, and actually one of the most honest things he has said throughout that the whole show. Like, that's why I enjoyed that moment, was because it was him, it was raw him, and like, you know, he viewed it like he viewed it as Psyche not enjoying his raw emotions or his raw feelings, when actually I think she did. But
yeah,
he is now, because he views her as a muse, as an idol, like he doesn't want to view her human side, like
you said. I agree. But one of the interesting things is when they're on that date and he takes her to the bookstore, and he like, she has a very astute observation that where he's like, you know a lot of shit, like you know all these first editions and you know all these obscure authors, and that's really cool. And like, that's, I feel like that's the sort of thing that when you're a kid, you don't see as like important knowledge, that like the sort of like database collecting sort of thing and like extensive knowledge about niche topics. Like he knows all those obscure things so that he can find the most obscure book and then become obsessed with it, so that he won't ever have to like show his real self to somebody. But she points out that like, no, like you know a lot of really obscure French literature from the 18th and 19th century. Like that's pretty cool. But he, like, I don't know, like Hasuga is too much like me at that age in some ways, and but also like a foreign country and others, mm-hmm. and not just because this is an anime from Japan. He just, like, such a weirdo. Because, like,
he is.
I mean, I also think that there is kind of almost a Kare Kana sort of thing where she's this perfect girl that no one, like, really knows. And so the prospect of, like, some boy who just, like, wants to know her, like, and ultimately wants to know her so much that, like, he stole her uniform so he could feel like her gym uniform so she could feel close to him. And she's like, that's a bit weird, but okay. Like, I mean,
like, she's only interested in him because he is the first person who's ever expressed any romantic engagement with her. Unlike the sort of trope where, you know, what's that? Like, is it Karen in Gamers that turns down everybody? Like, yeah. She's never been asked out, so because everyone's, I guess, has been too scared to talk to her and see her as a romantic possibility, I guess.
Do you have any sort of particular reflections on the performances of the actresses or actors which you liked or didn't like?
I mean...
Go ahead, Ben.
Go ahead.
Because I'm going to show.
No, I mean, I just thought that Nakamura was stupendous, and it's really frustrating to me that you can't find that actress's name very easily online, because as much as the actress who voiced her, Issei Maria, the person who, like, gave the appearance and had this physical stuff and the way she thrashes around and screams and the way she kind of, like, moves in this weird lurching way, like, she's great and she deserves as much credit as the voice actress, but because of how anime works, like, there's only a few. Like, I had to really look and I didn't write it down because I'm an idiot, and so I can't say who the young girl is who played Nakamura Sawa, but she was a standout. And I don't know. I feel like the other one, this is a small call out, but Saiki's friend, Kinoshita Ai, is, like, the secret hero of this anime, because she's, like, the normal girl who just, like, keeps yelling, like, talk to each other, and she's got a very, like, hands-on-hips posture sort of thing.
Yeah, she's, like, the actual voice of common sense, which no one listens to.
Yeah. Because she, at the end, when she brings them together, brings Kasuga and Saiki together to, like, talk about stuff after a month, and they just, like, quietly break up, and she's like, what the fuck? She's like, what's wrong with all of you people? Yeah. Like, I thought you guys were going to make up, but you just agree that you shouldn't be dating anymore? This is weird. This is so weird. And it was nice to have that voice a little bit. The show has a great sense of lightheartedness in its, like, physical comedy. Like, when Nakamura dumps water on Kasuga and they replay it, like, 12 times from all these different angles. Oh, it's so good.
Yeah. That didn't make me laugh. Not much. I mean, shall we move on to the elephant in the room then? Or is there anything else you want to mention?
I think
we're sort of describing the elephant.
I think we're headed there. So, yeah.
Yes. The art style is in a rotoscope. Everything is painted over live action, which simultaneously really draws out the sort of the tension and the ugliness of the story itself in a really, really effective way. But it's not the standard anime that people might expect when they, you know, just turn on the TV and, you know, look for something to watch. So it's not surprising that, like, if I had only seen pictures of it, I also probably would not have picked it out as something that was, you know, on my radar. And I'm really glad that you guys pitched it,
It is very deliberately ugly. It is... It's not quite in the Uncanny Valley, but it's somewhere there. It's on one of the slopes. Mm-hmm. It's disturbing. It's close enough to real to be disturbing, because it's not quite real. And I think what's interesting is which bits they've added on to what they recorded and which bits they've enhanced and which bits they've just left and took advantage of the fact they're rotoscoping. Because there's, like, moments where, say, one of the characters is screaming and you just see their body sort of shuddering after they've let out the scream, like this almost recoil as their breath comes back in and they're sort of just there shaking a little bit. And yet, equally, there was, like, a one of the I think, iconic scenes of the show is when Nakamura grabs Kasuga and tears his clothes off, which might sound like it should be sexual, but in this particular case, at least for one party, was not. It was more a ritual humiliation of the other. And it's like in that shot, that was a really interesting shot because you have this complete tangle of limbs, which would have been an absolute nightmare to film, well, to keyframe conventionally.
Mm-hmm.
But equally, there's this scene where you see the glass is tossed to one side and the buttons bouncing off past them, which is obviously not rotoscoped, because if they had rotoscoped that, they would have had to have placed the glasses down and then have someone throwing buttons at them until they got the perfect bounce. And so it's not as if they constrained themselves to absolutely only showing what the camera saw. They took what they wanted from it and then added what they felt was appropriate.
I understand why they did it. I feel that the way that the show is set, the way it's shot, it's set in an empty town, which is the manga that they named the town is actually the town that they shot on location. So they have actually gone on location to the real town that the mangaka originally drew. And then also, like I mentioned, the conversations, which were so human and real and not anime at all, I think is probably another part of why they did it. And then the other thing is that I guess because it's not a ridiculous anime, they wanted to have a weird crossover with anime fans and drama fans, so that they can try and get them maybe to say, like, hey, J-drama isn't so bad. Maybe I should watch some J-drama. And people who like drama go, hey, anime isn't so bad. Maybe I should watch some anime stuff. But it just fails on its ass. I'm sorry, it's fucking ugly.
It's supposed to be ugly, though. That's the exact point. If it looked beautiful, then you would have a temptation to like the characters, and you'd like, no.
The writing and the show, is like, the writing and the characters will... If they had done it, with the original art style, which isn't the best art style, but it is an art style that writer has, and is very good and is very beautiful. Like, it would work so much better. For a start, they wouldn't have wasted so much money on the animation because they had to shot it, then redrew it, and then you have also on top of that, you have really boring shots of nothing happening, of like,
oh my god,
static frame.
So wrong.
Of like, I'm not. Okay, I don't think
okay.
I am.
No, okay, Andy, and then, let me ask.
And then, like the fucking worst thing is that the reason the Blu-ray had the live action on it. So why the fuck do they even bother? Because it already had a live action. If you just bought the Blu-rays, which nobody did, because nobody had any interest in it. The best part of that whole thing is what the director said, which, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but it was like, yeah, I made an ugly fucking thing, but if it means that people are going to read the original material, then that's a good thing. And it's like, it just baffles me why they even fucking did it. Cause
no, it's so good. It's like, here, so let me lay it down for you. Okay, hear me out. What is the theme of this? Is it the theme of the appearances that people put on to seem normal to each other? And so what you do is you film a J drama and then you rotoscope an ugly ass anime over it. It's like it is literally, you are being forced to look at these characters the way that Nakamura looks at the world, the way that Kasuga thinks he looks at the world. You have this disgusting artifice papered over superficially normal stuff. You're figuratively seeing people transforming into like the shit-eating maggots that that Nakamura always talks about. You have normal people who are rendered alien, ugly, strange by the simple act of being transformed into a story. I think that's amazing. Long still shots of these, like, the way that the show builds atmosphere with these like long things, the fact that the first set of scenes are these incredibly daring, brave shots of empty streets and
it's like I was going to say, like, the town itself, when you see some of the source photos, you see that they've took what was, like, a fairly averagely worn place and made it into this very, very dilapidated place.
The town is actually based on the mangaka Shuzo Oshimi's hometown.
Mm.
He had actually gone back to his home from Tokyo for reference photos when he was doing the manga. And the manga, like, the style of the manga is very much, like, it's pretty standard. Like, you can, Nakamura in the manga basically just looks like Rei Ayanami from Evangelion. Similarly, Kasuga basically just looks like Shinji. Like, there's very, you know, it's so, very conventional in that way. It's
probably even more on the iconified end of that, the almost chibi Rei and chibi Shinji.
Yeah. And the treatment that the show gives it, like, it seems like they did absolutely from the frames of the manga, like, the way the show is shot is in some ways extremely faithful to the progression of events, the settings. Like, it looks like some of the scenes were shot at the same locations as the reference photos were taken.
Oh, I thought you were saying it was too expensive, and now it's too cheap.
No, well, they ran out of money, so they had to, you know, fill some dead air with some boring shots of towns.
No, calling it boring. Sometimes, I mean, the fact that you call it boring means that it worked, because, like, this isn't supposed to be exciting. It's not supposed to be beautiful.
But like I said,
like, I've seen the shots from the manga, and all, like, Nakamura looks pretty, and that is not how Nakamura should look. Nakamura looks fuckable, and that is not how Nakamura should look. She should look like a weird space alien, and that's what they do. Like, it's, I think that the way that the art builds its atmosphere, and the way that it takes normal-looking things and makes them look unfamiliar, is exactly what I think that the art style should achieve.
There's a scene where Kasuga is about to go on a date with Seki, and Nakamura corners him and forces him to wear the gym outfit that Kasuga had stolen. And, you know, this horrible, awkward situation is just something that she's just dying to see. And she just lets out this primal scream that just takes over her whole body. Like, it's a fantastic performance. Like, maybe we can include a gif of it in the show
notes.
She just
shakes her head round, and she's like, just fully goes into the scream. It's like her whole body becomes the scream. It's like her head sort of cranes up and back, and she's just looking at the ceiling and just screaming.
And that's an entirely original performance, because if you look at that same, like, it's like, you know, that almost that same shot is taken right out of the manga, but in the manga it's very static. She's just screaming directly into his face, like ramrod straight up, and it's just this wonderful performance that you probably would not have gotten otherwise.
Yeah.
If it was just traditionally done.
I mean, I respectfully disagree, because I think that they could have easily have done that with the original art or something that wasn't rotoscoped. Like, if they wanted to get that across, they could have done it in so many more visual ways than the ways that they did in this show. And, like, they also just did nothing with, like, any sort of, like, the transition to rotoscope from, like, you know, original, from the shot drama stuff to the rotoscope meant that they had some artistic license, which they only pulled off once in the dream sequence. And, like, they could have done more with that, but they didn't. They just, it just felt like a wasted opportunity, and it felt just really rubbish. I just hated every time that I saw them. And, like,
I think that's the point, though.
I don't know if it is.
The director literally said that he wanted his art style to, like, inflict a wound on his audience, and it sounds like he did. It sounds like he stabbed you in the heart, mate.
Well, yeah, but I just feel that I think it's also then stabbed the original artist in the heart, who spent, you know, a lot of time, like, crafting his skill, and it's not been represented justfully. I think that's like a bit disgusting that a director thinks that he can apply his own fucking, like, thoughts on that? I mean, we've had discussions with other stuff about people not respecting their original like art form, or like the mangaka's original art, which is fine when it's not very good, but when it is good, I think it's just
I don't,
like,
I don't think
shame.
It, I mean, point the first, the manga's still there, the director didn't go out and burn all the copies of it, and point the second, like, I think that employing this extremely ambitious, like, this extremely ambitious art style is the best homage that an adapter can make. Like, if they just wanted someone to just completely faithfully translate the manga to an anime, like what's happening with, say, Ancient Magus Bride, which John, who loves the manga, is really disappointed by the anime because it's so faithful. Like, I like that this is, we now have two versions of the same story, and one, like, even if you, as you do, hate the anime, you can still love the manga. And I find the manga's art kind of boring and cutesy, and I think that the anime is an absolute marvel, and I was spellbound throughout all of it. I watched it in less than 3 days. I couldn't stop watching it. We both get what we want. This is the best possible world.
I couldn't watch it unless I was running at the gym. That's the only way I could watch it. I was at a gym. I was it's also then like really janky stuff because they only did it 8 frames per second, which is just, again, okay. It's just a waste.
So, Andy, have you ever heard the phrase the uncanny valley?
Oh, yeah, obviously.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when we talk about that, we talk about things being so close to being real that they actually become disturbing, because the things we look for in normality and reality are there, but not quite right. And
I mean,
this is what it does.
I don't think it's trying to be a disturbing anime.
I disagree.
It's just trying to display a person's like weird life for like that he's experiencing. Like, it's not scary. It's not creepy. It's just a guy and the weird shit that he does.
I will say my argument that it's supposed to be disturbing, unsettling. Have you listened to the ending music?
Yeah, and I fucking hate it.
It's amazing. What's wrong with you, Andy?
It's trying to put on some sort of like creepy air of something that isn't meant to be creepy or disturbing. It's just a slight a slice of life of some guy who's done some like did one fucked up thing and then watching it all snowball. It's not.
He
a,
did multiple.
It's not a horror.
Sorry, it's just. I shouldn't laugh, but Andy describing. I know. It's just I've never heard the term slice of life applied to the. Quite
it is
such
a slice
a show.
Of life.
Andy,
it's
you
a slice of life.
Andy, you literally just said that your fiance would never forgive you if you stole her gym uniform. So it's not just one fucked up thing. It's an act of emotional violence that reverberates out in this guy's life and draws in other people like a black fucking hole. It's supposed to reveal how normal things are sick and gross. Like, that's the point.
But
is all of this like disgusting
not...
flower growing in people's lives?
And yeah, and I don't know how relatable you found the show, but like it was very nice, you know, to see, you know, any kind of media where you feel seen and then also just mercilessly dragged.
Yeah, it's like he's
mocked for it.
He's like anyone who's like a slightly bookish teenager. There's some of the worst of you is in Kasuga.
Yeah. That, yeah. And just the alienation, which leads to sort of, you know, just being trapped in your own head and, you know, trying to build the world out of your very, very limited perspective, and also trying to build your own identity over your own perspective. Because part of the theme of the show is that nobody really knows, you know, who anybody else is, but we also don't necessarily know ourselves until we show somebody else who that is.
Yeah, and I think the midpoint of the series is like the one point where they allow them a moment of connection and sort of mm-hmm. catharsis, and that's when they Nakamura and Kasuga basically go on a sort of mini vandalism rampage of their classroom. And mm-hmm. just it's like she tells him, right, you're going to sort of confess what you've done, all these bad things, write them up on that blackboard, do it now. And he's sort of repulsed by the idea of doing it, but the choice she gives him is that either you do this or you accept that you're just like everyone else. She's like, it's almost like the cliche, I'm not mad at you, I'm just disappointed.
Yeah, yeah.
And he can't accept that. He can't accept being normal. And so he just goes full on, and he just, he fills the board full of everything she asked and more. And then he just starts wrecking the classroom. And I still find it one of the most weirdly beautiful scenes in anime. There's this where which you couldn't do without rotoscoping, because they have him grab a brush and ink and just start painting the walls and the floor, and just it happens in slow motion, and it's it's ink like blood almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's like reading too much into it to say destruction as sex is certainly part of what's going on, and like there's like this moment of intimacy between the two, and like this ink and these ecstatic faces, and it's a very weird and beautiful scene.
I mean, I think this is obviously, I think this is also why they chose the animation style that they did. Like, everything is very human and very real. The conversations are very realistic. And I think that's also why it's so good, is because they feel like human conversations and they feel like real people.
Yeah. I think that it is lucky that, like, the very exaggerated style of Japanese, like, television acting, when it's rotoscoped into anime, becomes very, like, low-key and understated, because they can't overact like I'm used to having Japanese drama overact. It, like, yeah, it's very passive and very, like, painterly almost. I don't know.
Yeah, the show is so intentionally ugly for so much of the time, and there are points at which you wonder, you know, why did they even bother doing this at all, like this style? But there are moments, like you were saying, you know, this scene when he is, you know, chasing after Nakamura and the, you know, the iconic flower of evil, which is a recurring motif throughout the show, is blooming all around him. And they make use of the freedom that rotoscoping gives them.
Yeah,
and when they do it, it really is, you know, comes out in like a stark contrast to the rest of the show, unlike something like, you know, Waking Life, where the whole time everything is just a little bit off and a little bit weird and a little bit swimmy to make you feel like, oh, this is a dream. Like, whereas this one, you know, it feels like, you know, the posture and the physical performances of the actors, everything feels very rooted until it becomes detached from reality. But the rotoscoping allows them to do it so seamlessly that it's just very beautiful.
Yeah, you have to have, it's like, what is the baseline? And the baseline of Flowers of Evil is just this ugly reality. And it's like full of flaws and very much
and
not something you want to look at too hard.
And it's probably also not a mistake that the most color that's ever in any scene is typically Nakamura's, like, bright red hair.
Yeah. And it is a very dark palette a lot of the time. It's all
very muted, very gray and green, blues.
And I think it's also, like, it's messy. I think that's the other thing to say about style. And as a stylistic choice, when you choose to do something like this, it's by its very nature messy, and when you iconify something like any animation typically does, you get this ability to pick and choose what you think significant. And mm-hmm. occasionally that can be amazing. Occasionally you can do astonishing things with it, and it almost defines the medium. But what rotoscoping allows you to do is to accidentally find those things.
Yeah. Yeah. The bodies do things that we're not consciously aware of, but we'll pick up on when they're missing. Rotoscoping gives it a humanity that the manga lacks, and the performances by the actors are phenomenal in some cases. Yeah. Especially Nakamura, the sort of, you know, the dark end of the love triangle between.
You would hope that Kasuga was a good performance as well, because if there's anyone who's really that spineless and pathetic, then it's probably not a very good
that's
thing
true,
for them.
That's true. As I've gotten older, I've realized that the best actors are the people who just play completely unredeemable scumbags, because it's easy to find somebody who is naturally charismatic and handsome to carry a role that calls for something like that, but it takes talent to be a piece of shit.
He's extremely weaselly. Mm-hmm. It's like people who get typecast as that, like Steve Buscemi, for instance. Like Steve Buscemi has charisma compared to him by a long way. He's just like almost irredeemable. It's I mean, that's the strength of the performance. He's supposed to be that.
I know. I clearly am not going to win this argument, but I'm going to die on my heel.
We're not. It's a difference of opinion, like you said. Like I think our least disappointing spotlights for me are the ones where we're all like, oh yeah, it's good, or the ones where we're like, oh yeah, it's not that good. And I like that. Like last year I wrote like the top five anime I watched, not necessarily the top five anime of that year, but just like the top five anime I watched, and it was really fun to like write that, and then like a week later watch something that's easily going to be in my top five of the things I've seen this year. Like I thought it was amazing, and the fact that you thought it was garbage and a betrayal, but at the same time, like, you have cool stuff to say about it. Like this is the dream for spotlights for me, I feel like, is having an interesting difference of opinion.
Yeah, I mean, but the cool things I have to say about it are purely like the original story and nothing to do with the art style, which I just find. Like, they could have gotten rid of, they could have done a J-drama, they could have done an original animation, and it would have been, like, just as good, it would have been better, and I just wish that they hadn't gone down the route that they did. The story itself is fascinating and very intriguing, and I will be reading the manga as soon as I've, like, as soon as, you know, we're done, because I want to see how it continues. Like, the twist at the end that, you know, Nakamura is now going to have a contract with, what's his name? Natsuki. I think is very interesting. What was his name?
Kasuga?
Kasuga.
Yeah.
Like, I think that.
Now I'm just thinking Natsumi's Book of Friends mixed with this. Natsumi's Power of Evil.
Natsumi's Book of Friends in this show. But yeah.
No, I mean, but like when you read it, like, you're going to be hearing their voices and thinking of how those people move, probably. No, like, I don't think, how can you forget how Nakamura moves and looks? And you're going to see her in your head when you're seeing that cutesy girl face on the manga page.
I'm not. I'm just going to be seeing the cutesy girl face and be like, this is how it should have been. Like, I think that. I mean, also, if you're talking about the rest of the cast, like, there's, for a start, we mentioned the like, apart from the central three, the rest of the performances were fucking dire. There was that, like,
yeah, Yamada or whatever, the fat weird friend was like annoying and not like that was where the like J drama style of acting really leaked through. Yeah. I felt like was
his two friends actions. Too much at all.
They also all looked like 30-year-olds in a school uniform, which I couldn't stand. And then you also had there was one classmate and who was a famous comedian. Who is a guy dressed up? Who is a guy who has pigtails at the front of his head?
Yeah.
And every time he was in shot, I was like, "Why the fuck are you there? Like, you're trying to ground this in reality. You're trying to ground this in a place that I will believe in. But you've got like front and center this famous comedian that I know and looks really weird and is clearly a guy with like
female like dread hair. I don't know him that well, so I don't want to be like, he's clearly a guy dressed as a girl, because I don't want to, you know, bash on that stuff, because I don't. But I just think that, like, the fact that he's there just shows that they don't give a fuck about trying to be realistic, and they just want to get more people to watch it by going, hey, there's that comedian you like. He's got, like, two lines, but he's there, and he's in, like, a bunch of show, like, episodes. And it's just so, like, if you're trying to say, like, yes, the animation is jarring and that's why it's great, sure, I can buy that, but then why did they do that? You know?
I don't know. I didn't notice it. I was looking at other stuff.
To a certain degree, if you're aware who that guy is and we're not, then you're obviously going to get something from that we're not, and which some of the audience would have got, which we would not. But
the reason is, why the fuck is that guy there?
I suppose the most obvious one is the what. Obvious other thing which is like that is the, as we said, the bookshop owner with his paintbrush moustache.
His moustache that was wonky. I was like, fuck off, why is it there? I mean, it wasn't straight. That was what really annoyed me. It was like, no man would have a moustache that is permed up on the left half. Like, you can't just get that naturally. You have to actually put, like, gel in and perm it. Like,
I just liked how he was like, okay, he's like this weird enabler for him. He's like, yeah, here, have this book, and he's like, yes, young man, that's correct. Yeah, and nodding and sort of stroking his chin and going, yes.
He wasn't much of a character. He wasn't there. He was like, had two lines and was just a stand-in of the mangaka, which I didn't realize, but. Even then was even like weirder, because I was like, why did they not fix his mustache? If they shot it and then they drew it, why didn't they fix it at least when they redrew it?
I mean, in his case, the obvious answer is because they're inserting someone from outside the story in the story. Because if in the manga car inserts himself there, here the director's inserting himself, because he's the creator of this little world in both cases. So that makes some sense for him showing up. But I must admit, I do not understand what was going on with the ponytail guy, and that didn't add anything. But on the other hand, for me, it didn't subtract anything, which it evidently did to you.
For me, every time, it just broke the illusion. Just like, even when I was buying into the story, I saw him and it just broke it. I was like, oh yeah, this fuckhead's here. Why is he here? he appears in a lot. He has a couple of lines, but he appears in it a lot, and I'm just like, it's a shame. And then also, when I noticed him, every time there was a shot of the classroom, I was like, oh, where's that ponytail fuckhead? Like, it infuriated me. Like, so much of this anime infuriated me. Which is, I mean, if that is the director's purpose, then I guess it worked. But it will be interesting to know, like, whether it makes, like, if they re-release it, whether it will sort of change after 20 years and people having some, like, time to reflect on it. And like you said, Ben, say, like, oh yeah, he was purposely trying to do that art style. But somehow, I doubt it.
Well, yeah, you don't like it, so of course you're going to doubt it. I had a very weird situation where I was given a bunch of anime for Christmas a couple years ago, and it was all like stuff I already had. So it was from a physical store. So I had to go back and exchange all of that. And I just got the three things that I didn't already have on Blu-ray that were at the store, which were like Flowers of Evil, Yurikuma Arashi, and something else. And so I've had it on Blu-ray for like 2 years and always been like, I've always heard that it's like kind of weird and depressing and off-putting, and so I was putting it off, and I was glad that I had it, and I was able to just like make myself a cup of tea and sit down on the couch and watch some weird rotoscoped kids wrestle for a while.
Yeah.
And that ending, especially, we made a brief reference to it, but they have a very interesting thing at the end where apparently, I thought this was an artistic choice, but apparently it is like their pitch for giving them a second season is just this like fast flashing of events of like the next year or so of all the weird bullshit they're going to be involved in. And I thought that was a great way to like, you think that they've finally reached a place of equilibrium, but no, there's more shit coming.
The end of the show is a very, you know, evocative and affecting scene. You know, you have this moment where, you know, Nakamura has rejected him. He is trying to get her back. He tackles her and says, I want to be with you. I want to help you. And then you just get this flash forward of this just terrifying series of events of them basically just tearing each other and their families apart. You know, he doesn't want to be well. He wants to be special, and he can be special with her, even though it's, you know, suicidal.
I think John's described it as this perfect ending where you just see how they've just this moment where they just like they hit the ignition button. They've locked themselves into this rocket to oblivion, and this is where they're heading.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it headed nowhere because it didn't do very well.
Yeah, unfortunately, that was a foregone conclusion. Like, I mean, if you make whether or not you like it, Andy, like I agree that if you make something that's supposed to be ugly and upsetting, and you say that you're gonna like wound your audience by making them watch this, like, yeah, you're not gonna be a financial success. And that's too bad that people can't make weird and off-putting stuff because they have to like pay them bills, but that's how it happened.
I think the director has said as much in an interview during at a convention the year after the show came out. People had asked him, you know, is this flash forward, you know, is that supposed to be a teaser, is that supposed to be the ending? And he was saying that, you know, that was their last, you know, attempt at trying to drum up excitement for more in the future, which, you know, we live in a weird time now where, you know, people reach back and grab things that at the time were not as popular but have become sort of cult favorites. So maybe at some point in the future we'll see more, but we'll probably never will.
I think uniquely among all anime, we can't, because they've grown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They'll be out of teenagers to distinctly young adults now.
Mm-hmm.
5 years? Yeah, 5 years.
So,
I mean,
yeah.
As I was saying to Ben before we started recording, I've started reading the manga past this point, and the thing is, it's huge. It's at least three, perhaps four times the length of the series, and I can't imagine this as like a 48-episode series.
Mm-hmm.
I should say that it is better than Bartender. Like, at the end of the day, I was thinking, like, you can't make me watch something that's worse than Bartender, and then I thought this would be it, but it's better than Bartender.
Bartender's boring, and whatever you say about those long silences in Flowers of Evil, like, stuff happens every episode. There's something that happens.
And sure, there are long silences, which it's boring. But, like, it's not the long silences that I didn't like. It was the kind of static directorial shots that were, I mean, so it's kind of not the same, because, you know, like, a lot of anime has, like, repeats a lot of sets anyway, but I feel that if it had gotten an anime, or a J-drama adaption purely, it would have gotten a lot more movement, it would have gotten a lot more dynamicism, like, you know, just a lot more engaging stuff that you see on screen, rather than what you get, which was a lot of the same shot of them like peering into their sort of like kitchen and then just like talking and then him walking off. So, and it's just like, it's no following shots. There's very few action shots. Like,
I will again argue that that's the point, that like the like alienated distant camera that is kind of stagnant is part of building a visual tone in the anime. Mm-hmm. But so I think we'll just
I think that there is a point to that, I agree, but I also think that it's mostly because it's cheap.
I'm kind of glad that it does have the room to breathe of a, you know, a full 13 episode season, because the pacing of the show, like, I found this show unbelievably watchable. Like, I watched the whole thing in like less than 24 hours. It was so gripping, but at the same time it has this just relentless grinding pace to it, right? You know, everything is very subdued, and, you know, except for when it isn't, but everything is just so compelling and so it just clawed me in.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the sort of the other thing which provides it pace is the soundtrack, which is, again, to me, it immediately sort of makes me think of some of Nine Inch Nails' sort of more down, less extravagant albums, things like... like
Downward Spiral and Hearts of the Fragile.
Yeah. Just these, there's a almost 10-minute shot where after the episode after they've had their moment of release with the wrecking of the classroom, where they're just walking hand in hand from the school, and it starts with this music just being like a sort of ambient, almost relaxing
sound. It feels like a new world.
Yeah, it's like
a new dawn.
Like this almost has a very like a feel of water to it. But it's, if you're listening to it, you can just pick up these little occasional discordant notes, not always loud, but still there. And as the sequence sort of pans out, they just go from the background to the foreground and just take over. And by the end, it's just has distinct menace to it. It's it's like, I mean, the best sort of analogy for it I've sort of came up with at the time is it's like he's just getting swept along, and it's, the music sort of reflects this idea that he's like losing sight of the coasts, and he doesn't quite realize it. And there's this where it's going from just being like this thing he's done to becoming dangerous. And then we've got the OP music, and which it there's is the four or three? I think there's
there's four. There is because it all, like, all the OPs are in the voices of the different characters while also sort of carrying some of their characters. So, you know, the one with Kasuga is somewhat like downbeat and like, and then the Nakamura one is just like, it's as wild as her. Yeah, and I personally love that one.
Nakamura sounds and is a terrible person, but there's an
honesty to it.
Yeah, there's a she demands attention. She is to say attractive is wrong, but magnetic maybe.
Yeah, attractive in the way that a flame is attractive to a moth.
And then
I could burn to death in there. That sounds great.
I mean, I just liked the general tone of the soundtrack, with like its droning and groaning and like kind of weird dissonant strings. Like, I think it upheld the same. I think it was an audio style that was in keeping with the visual style, and I thought it worked great. I found the performances kind of average, although, I mean, a lot of them involved screaming and yelling. So, I mean, they seemed fine to me. I don't really have that much interesting to say. Sorry, there. I'm not much of an audio person.
To a close then on that.
Yeah.
I have not much more interesting to say. Note.
I'm just boring. I just watched this anime to because I thought I was impressive.
You pitched this anime because you thought you wanted to impress people.
No, I mean, no. Duncan pitched it, so yeah, Duncan will be the chooser this time. We'll have to think what I can pick that'll make Duncan happy and also give. Yeah. I mean, I'll link the poems themselves, but they're actually like, they're mostly very sensual. They're not like, there are bits about evil, but evil is often the act of hedonism and of being selfish with your lover as opposed to being a functioning human being. So
yeah, he really didn't understand that.
I was reading them because I hoped it'd give me a perspective on the work, but But as the work itself says, like, yeah, the poems aren't important. It's just about something that's, like, weird and difficult to read, which they are. So,
I mean,
yeah,
I'll
link them in the show notes. But
it should also be pointed out that the Aku no Hana in the Japanese, the Aku, which means evil, is using an old kanji and not the one that is currently used. So whilst, you know, there is the literal sense, that whilst there is sort of like the emotion, what is it? The theoretical sense of this is hard to read, like this is hard to understand. It's also literally hard to read in Japanese because they use odd kanji and hard to read like letters. So that is another sort of layer that I guess might have been lost in translation. But that is something that, I don't know, I thought that you'd be interested in that.
Interesting.
No, that's my shit. I like that stuff. Thanks, Andy.
No, you can really thank Mids, who pointed that out to me.
Thanks, Mids, if you listen to this. Anyway, well done, okay, let's go ahead and say goodbye. Remember, rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. Find us on Twitter, KeyframesPod. Find us on Facebook, Keyframes Podcast. Email us questions. We'll answer anything anime or anime adjacent at keyframespodcast@gmail.com. Say goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Did you miss it, Duncan?